I am so pleased to have a guest back from Canada who hasn't been on in too long. Actually, his name is Professor David Staines, professor of English at the University of Ottawa, formerly Dean of the Faculty of Arts. And he's an internationally respected scholar of medieval as well as Canadian literature and culture, author of more than 20 books. He's got a series of books on Canadian writers such as Carol Shields, Alice Munro, Morley Callahan. In fact, last time he was on, I think we were discussing his edition of Morley Callahan's novel, The Loved and the Lost. His most recent publication, February of 2020, is Robert Crouch. How do you say it?
Crouch.
Crouch, essayist, novelist, and poet, University of Ottawa Press. Been honored by the Royal Society of Canada. And his published letters of Stephen Leacock, who's a great writer. I looked into him, David, after your recommendation. Listed of one of the 100 best books of the year in the year it was published. He was also invested into the Order of Ontario and the Order of Canada. David, thanks for joining me again.
It's a pleasure.
Well, you know, the name Marshall McLuhan came up, and you told me something I probably should have intuited, and that is you studied with him and you knew him fairly well. Is that correct?
I did. That was a long time ago, in the fall of 1966, when I enrolled in Marshall's course on modern poetry and drama. And there were about 25 of us in the course, and he was there twice a week, every week throughout the year. And I listened to him, we talked, and then later in his life, I came to know him very well, because I asked him to come down to Harvard where I was teaching. And it was a strange lunch we had in Toronto because he said, "Why should I come to Harvard?" I didn't understand that he had antipathy to certain places or whatever. And he said, "Well, why should I come?" And I simply said, "Because of me." And he said, "Okay, I'll come."
You actually published a book on McLuhan called Understanding Me, Lectures and Interviews. These were evidently essays by McLuhan that hadn't yet been published, with an introduction by Tom Wolfe.
That's right. They had never been published before. And a lot of them are very interesting because the book is an introduction to McLuhan through his own words. And it travels the whole sphere from early to late. It has so many important things that he believed in and thought and said. And so it's an interesting little volume.
Well, you know, some of our listeners who are largely Catholic, as you know, may not know that he was a convert to the faith.
Well, he was. He took instructions. He really converted, he said to me once, because of Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton, because these were writers he knew of, and he started to see what they were saying about Catholicism. And the more he investigated, the more he turned to that. And so he was baptized while he was at the University of Wisconsin. His godfather was John Pick.
Hopkins scholar, yeah.
Yes, he did all that. I don't know who his godmother was.
Yeah.
I never found that out. But Pick was his godfather. And from there on, he was a devout Catholic. He would go to Mass and Communion every day. When I had him as a teacher back in 1966, he would go off to the church on campus, which was St. Basil's, to 1210 Mass. And anyone coming to meet him would be told, "I will go to lunch with you at 1245. And they never understood why he wasn't in his office till 12:45.
He was at Mass.
Exactly.
And, you know, I watched today about an hour and a half of his videos of him, interviews on television, lectures. And I had two or three reactions. One, utterly brilliant. I mean, blowing the top off my head, blowing the top off the head of everybody you talk to. Secondly, mischievous. And thirdly, totally unique thinker. I mean, totally. He wasn't imitating anybody. Am I right?
That's right. That's right. And I remember an interview he did, and he was going on and on about what he thought and all this, and then he finally said, they asked him, what do we take too seriously? And he looked at the camera and said, me.
Ha! Yes.
That's the sense of humor he had.
And, you know, one thing I noticed, his energy always seemed to be up. Was he that way in the classroom?
It was in the classroom. He'd be that way at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday or whatever time we met. And he would speak spontaneously, extemporaneously about the books we were studying. And they were fascinating. Because he'd talk for 5 or 10 minutes about the poems or the plays we were reading, and then he'd drift off to other areas of his thought of modern literature and modern culture. And then as the hour came to a close, he'd say, and this is all relevant to whomever we were studying, whether it was Arthur Miller or whomever, and he'd walk out of the room.
Well, you were in his classroom right at the sort of the pinnacle. He had published Gutenberg Galaxy in 62, Understanding Media, perhaps his most influential book, in 64. And he was just about to publish The Medium is the Massage in 1967. So this was a guy at the time you had him in class who was really a star, right?
He was, and the year after I had him in class, he went off to Fordham University on this big grant and was there for a year. And that's when he got so unbelievably sick and was under operation for the longest period of time up until then that anyone had been unconscious.
For what?
Brain difficulties, something to do with the brain. And it was a very delicate and serious
operation. Brain tumor. Yeah, brain tumor.
Something like that.
And he would end up dying rather young. He was died at age 69 in 1980. The surgery that you speak of is 68. But he lived, it wasn't until 11 years later he had a stroke.
That's right. That's right. He had the stroke, was it September, I think, before he lived with a stroke for 15 months. And he couldn't during that time talk. And so I didn't want to disturb him, though we got along really well. Because I kept hearing these stories about his incapacities.
Right.
So I didn't disturb him at all, which was probably folly on my part, but I didn't want to. And then at his funeral, which I was at, I came down from Ottawa, we took to the funeral Sheila Watson, who was a great Canadian writer, who was Marshall's student. And she stayed with the McLuhans during the funeral ceremony and that time. And she came to me at after the funeral and said, Corinne, Mrs. McLuhan, wants to know.
From Fort Worth, Texas.
Exactly. She wants to know why she's never seen you.
Oh, that must have stung.
And I felt terrible, and I said, well, I didn't want to disturb her in those problem times. And she said, well, you've got to come to his house tomorrow because there's going to be mass tomorrow, and Corinne wants you there.
You were closer than you realized to the family.
He was close to me. I mean, yeah. I can tell anecdotes that prove this, but you learn by retrospect.
You know, I learned that lesson early. I was at Princeton, and my seminary and my teacher, Carl Friedrich Froelich, was in the hospital with a heart attack. And like you, I didn't want to disturb him, even though we were very close. And when I came out, and I took him to Bach C minor Mass, you know, to celebrate his recovery. And he said, why didn't you come see me? And same thing, David. I thought I would be disturbed. He says, you could have come and read me Psalms. That would have been wonderful.
But you were in the same position I was.
That's right.
I couldn't go.
And and I know I felt that. I felt numb after hearing that. I really did.
Yeah.
What was that mass like? What was that day like when you went over to the house after the funeral?
It was a private mass just for the family who were there, by this priest who was an old friend of McLuhan's, and he had it in the living room, and Sheila was there, and I was there, and the family. And
that was it.
Yeah.
Well, that's where you stood, and you were a student, you were humble enough to, you know, not realize it.
Yeah, I guess so.
This was years later. You had been a student originally, but what kind of relationship had you had between the time you were a student and the time he died?
Well, a colleague, a student who was with me in 1966-67 called me one night and gave me a lecture on what I should do to get into graduate school, and I should get letters from people like McLuhan because they're important. And so I never asked McLuhan for a letter. I couldn't play that academic supposed game.
I know, I know that.
It's so offensive. And so when I invited Marshall, and then I got to know Marshall later in the year because we had a professor from New York University, Robert Corrigan, and he was a friend of Marshall's, so we spent an evening together. But then when I asked him down to Harvard, and he came and gave a complex lecture, and then the next day he met with my class, and then I had him back to talk in my own apartment, over lunch with all the students.
Oh, that's nice.
And the students talked and raised questions, and he answered every one of them.
He was a mensch.
He just so enjoyed being there.
Yeah.
And then later, I wanted to bring a book out of the various people who'd come to Harvard and given the talks. And so I invited Marshall to contribute an essay, the gist of his talk. And he said he'd be delighted to do that.
Wow.
Well, the book was all together. And the only essay that hadn't come in was Marshall's. And so I came back from Cambridge to Toronto, and I was going to see him for lunch. And I said, Marshall, you didn't contribute an essay. Oh, Stan will write it. And I said, no, you have to write it. He said, I can't write it unless you're here. And so I said, okay, I will come back from Cambridge in 2 weeks' time, and we will sit and we will write the essay. You will write it and I will read it.
Right.
And he said, fine. And so 2 weeks I came back, and Monday morning I went down to his office and he said, here's the essay. And he had written 4 pages. And
oops.
He said, now we can write the rest.
No,
now you can write the rest.
Oh, no.
And so for that whole week, he worked on the essay. And it's a brilliant essay.
What was the name of it?
The Borderline Case.
Was that reprinted in your collection of McLuhan?
Yes, it is. It is.
Good.
It's the last essay in the book. And Marshall, the funny thing is the last day, and one day I went off to lunch with another professor, and Marshall sort of scolded me. I thought you were going to be here. And I said, no, I need breathing space. And one night we had dinner and talked. And so on the Friday, I was going off somewhere for lunch and he was going off somewhere. And when I came back, Margaret Stewart, who was his secretary, said to me jokingly, but she said, you know, when you left, Marshall turned to me and said, I finally met Simon Legree.
Wow.
And so I sat there and Marshall came in and I said, I'm not Simon Legree. And he said, oh, I meant that as a compliment. How you could ever take that as a compliment, I don't know. But it was very amusing.
He was one of these guys that was always kind of sitting off sparks, sounds like.
That's right. And he was a genius in so many ways because he was always alive in his brain, whether at 6 p.m. or 9 a.m. He was always thinking and probing, to use a word he loved to use. And it was difficult because how many people are on that level?
How many people have that energy?
That's right. I mean, we would work all day on the essay from 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock or 5:30. And then he'd say, come on up to the house and have dinner with me. And so I'd go up and have dinner with him and with Corinne. And we just talk and he was constantly thinking.
How did Corinne take that?
Well, she was a beautiful woman and a great lady, and she'd talk us down. We'd come in and she'd say something, and she'd say something totally normal, and they were inseparable. They were inseparable until the very end.
They had like what, 6 children?
6.
Yes. I watched a Canadian Broadcasting Company documentary on McLuhan today, and some of the boy children were interviewed, and they had a kind of seriousness that seemed to come from their dad.
And yet there was so much humor to Marshall. There was so much lightness. There was so much fun. And in class, he would tell us jokes, and some were deplorable, and he'd get a kick out of them. And he loved puns. His book is riddled with puns. He used to tell us in class, one of his lines was from Browning, a man's reach should exceed his grasp. Or what's a metaphor?
I read an account of his conversion where he had taught a class like yours, and one of the students in it kept feeling this Catholicity that was coming out of his teaching. You know, you may have been referring to Chesterton and Belloc or something. And he went up to him after class and said, you know, I think said something like, you must be Catholic. And he said, no. And the student said something like, well, why not? And evidently he went directly from there to a priest to talk about entering the church. Do you know that story?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that.
And but again, you know, I said earlier that the originality of his thinking, he was not a literary critic in the sense of his teachers at Cambridge, I. A. Richards, F. R. Leavis.
Yeah, but yes, he was.
Okay.
Because his first articles for about 10 years were almost nothing other than literary criticism.
New criticism.
Yeah. And the first article he ever published, as far as I know, was a 1936 essay on G.K. Chesterton, a practical mystic.
Oh, I'd like
to find
that.
So that was written when he was what? 24 years old?
Well, was he running into Belloc and Chesterton books while he was at Cambridge?
Yes. That's where he first took them up. That's what he was reading.
And so he was a product of a institution that created a lot of Catholic converts.
That's right.
In the first half of the 20th century.
That's right.
And in fact, some people think too many. But he did, when he turned to the question of media, the mediums, and of the relationship between media, and this is going all the way back to, you know, the creation of the alphabet and so forth, and its impact on persons, the way they look at the world, on societies, how they're constructed, on the fact that content itself is, I may be overstating it, less important than looking at the relationship between the medium and the receiver of the message, that interaction contains very important philosophical issues, a set of issues that need to be investigated.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So it almost like... he wanted to, you know, I don't know how, can you tell me how that connects to the new criticism? I mean, what's the bridge between going from the principles of new criticism, close reading of the text without any regard for the biography of the author and all that, with his media attention, his media theory?
The one of his great talks in our class was that the content and the form, the medium and the message, are one and the same.
That's true of a poem.
You can't divorce one from the other. And that was paramount to anything he said to us about modern poetry or whatever.
It sounds like, did he know Owen Barfield or
any other crowd? I don't know.
But
the name never occurred in the conversations.
I guess that's the relationship, and I should have seen that the new critics said, you know, we're not trying to extract meaning from a poem, we're trying to understand how it means, how the relationship of words, punctuation and these things, how they create a meaning that can't be disconnected from the form. Correct?
Right. You can't connect. You cannot divorce the two.
You can't distill the essence of a poem.
That's right.
And that is, critics who deal with the history of ideas are very guilty of that kind of criticism. if you're trying to follow the idea of virtue, for example. And, of course, you've done all your medieval work on the Arthurian legend and so forth.
And remember that Marshall first turned to Thomas Nashe, a Renaissance figure.
Now, was he an epigrammist?
Pardon?
Was he a illustrator?
Yeah, no, he was a writer, and didn't Thomas Nashe serve as McLuhan's thesis subject at one point?
I'm trying to remember why I think of him as a writer of epigrams. Basically, you know, real quickly, what was Thomas Nashe known for?
He wrote a lot in the Renaissance, humorous, serious. He wrote a lot of good things. I have I don't love Thomas Nashe that much because Marshall was taking a speed reading course in our fourth year, and he said, you know what I did? I got up this morning and I read 600 pages of Thomas Nashe.
Oh my Lord.
And I thought, that's so boring.
Well, we're going to talk more about Marshall McLuhan with Professor David Staines of the University of Ottawa, who was Marshall McLuhan's student and friend, fellow scholar, and we'll be back in a moment. I am back with Professor David Staines of the University of Ottawa. He is internationally known as a scholar not only of Canadian literature and culture, but of medieval literature, including Chrétien de Troyes and the Arthurian legend material, Thomas Malory, I suppose. And we're talking about a man that he loved, obviously, a great deal, Marshall McLuhan. And it's time, David, that we turn a little bit to the substance of his thought. And it obviously made a very big impact. He was really a television celebrity. He was even showed up in a movie with Woody Allen, a very funny moment, Annie Hall. But can you try to outline the principles that govern his thought, especially in those major books, beginning with the Gutenberg Galaxy?
Well, the Gutenberg Galaxy was a great book, and after the Canadian Imagination, my book Essays, came out, Marshall gave me a copy of the Gutenberg Galaxy, a first edition,
nice.
Because he said, I want you to have this, because it's thanks to you that I wrote the essay.
Nice.
And that was really stunning to me. And that's the kind of thing Marshall did. He was very generous. And so you talk about his three major books, and some other books. But I knew him more as a literature scholar. I mean, that's what he taught us. And that's what he was for so many, many years. And he only went into this other realm because he was lecturing his students, I believe in Wisconsin, and he was lecturing them and talking about comics, and they didn't know anything about them. And so he continued to give us talks, but he wanted to explore what the students were at, where they were,
popular
culture, thinking, and that's what prompted him to write ultimately the Gutenberg Galaxy, which looks at a series of ads everywhere, and he talks about what's the subliminal message in some of them, what's the image they're trying to make. What are they trying to do?
And he talks about consequences.
That's
what are
right.
The consequences of this type of message.
Marshall although that's more about literature than about any of his media problems. But I remember I did a lecture on T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland.
Oh, wow.
After a brief introduction to the poem, he set out to explore the power of illusion. April is the cruelest month, he intoned, and then asked us what poem Eliot was evoking. Following a few moments' silence, someone answered, Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales. Pleased with this reply, McLuhan launched into a comparison of Chaucer's poem with Eliot's work, pausing at length to recognize the world of Chaucer's pilgrims and the godless world of Eliot, which had no place for a pilgrimage because its inhabitants did not recognize any god or any saint. And so Eliot was invoking Chaucer's poem, he said, to create a simultaneous reference point throughout the poem to another world that had the religious figures the wasteland could not embrace. And then he said, the human city in the wasteland is desiccated and deprived by mechanical repetition, whereas Chaucer's Pilgrims of Eternity represent the city in a very different way. They create their city as they go along the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And then he intoned, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, and asked us what poem Eliot was evoking. Walt Whitman's When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed, I replied nervously, and McLuhan proceeded to discuss Whitman's poem, pointing out that his elegy for the dead Abraham Lincoln was a perfect counterpoint to The Wasteland, for here too was no place for political heroes, for figures who could rally their people around a great vision. So Eliot's poem, and I've always remembered this, was a modern Canterbury Tales where there was no realm for pilgrims. And Whitman's was an elegy that the wasteland could not even fathom. And as many times as I've read and taught Eliot's poem since that morning,
right,
I've always remembered McLuhan's account of the poem's opening lines and Eliot's sense of the power of illusion.
And it's also the sign of a culturally sensitive person who's able to see those, recognize those illusions when they're there.
And who knew that they were instrumental to an understanding of a great poem.
And when you, for example, edited your books of medieval literature, did you struggle with how much to rely on guiding the reader with footnotes? Because this is, it occurs to me, since you're, you know, brought up how McLuhan illuminated the wasteland by something that might go in a footnote in somebody's edition.
That's right. And yet I've never read that anywhere, what he said. And yet I still remember it.
That's a long time ago, David.
Exactly. It was 1966 or 67, whenever it was on the court.
I had moments like that in my undergrad days that I still remember, too.
And I've never forgotten that.
Was he doing all of this off the top of his head?
Yes.
And
he rarely had any notes when he gave his lectures.
So he sounds like he relied on, he wanted to be in the moment, and he didn't want to be repeating stuff that he had memorized or had written somewhere else, or he wanted to be encountering the poem at that moment with you, with the students.
That's right. And he wanted us to be in the moment with him. And that's what the course was.
And I would imagine that was achieved with most students.
Yes, it was. It was.
It seems like a presence you could hardly resist.
Yes, that's true. And yet he was a simple, humble man. I think what is wrong with many people who write about Marshall or who think about him and all that is he was a very innocent man. I mean, he was built up because of his books and his lectures and all this to an incredible extent, traveling around the world. And then as the 70s came along, he lost some of his luster. And yet he couldn't understand that because he was innocent of everything in the first place.
Well, the issues he had posed needed to be continue to be debated and discussed going forward, especially as I think I read somewhere that some people think he predicted the creation of the Internet.
That's right. And he did that. He did that.
I mean, this was someone who was thinking way outside the box. And it seems like he's the kind of thinker that spawns other creative thinkers. He's the kind of thinker that throws out suggestions or suggestive theories or explanation that can really help someone who's receives it with the same kind of creativity in their own work.
That's right.
It's breathable, so to speak.
Yes, it really is. I remember the last time I ever saw him was. I was studying at the Huntington Library in California in the summer of 79. And Marshall was coming out with Corinne, because he had to see some people and talk to them and all this. And so I was invited to a dinner that one of his children had there for him. And I had written Marshall earlier and said, you know, I'm going to California. What I'd love to do is throw a lunch with a couple of actors from the Pasadena Playhouse who would remember Corinne.
Right.
Because that's where they met. And I never got an answer to the letter. And then I got a quick response saying, I can't plan anything now because I have to do what they want to do. And so I went to this dinner. And I was seated beside Corinne before dinner having drinks. And Corinne asked me about my mother because she had met her a couple of times. And we talked and then someone said, Daddy's talking. And so then we went into dinner and I was still seated beside Corinne. And Marsha was the other end of the table. And Corinne started to talk and, shh, Daddy's talking. And so he was carrying on a pontificating about this and pontificating about that. When dinner was over, I wanted to leave. I spoke to Corinne and said I was leaving and we'd see her back in Toronto. And I said to Marshall, and I'm going, and I'll see you again. And he said, I'm going to walk you out to your car. And I said, oh, no, don't bother. Please don't. And he said, no, I want to. And so he walked out, and he put his arm over my shoulder. And he said, at evenings like this, it's important that I have someone who knows me like you here.
Yeah, oh, how wonderful.
I can't carry on. And my heart just melted.
Right.
Because
right.
He was a pontificator who
but he was aware.
Pontificate. Exactly.
You know, it reminds me very much of the story that's told about the greatest golfer of all time, Robert Jones Jr. in Atlanta, and that whenever he was in any kind of social situation, and of course he was always the center of attention, you know, he would seek out people in the corner who are not talking to anybody and bring them in. He was constantly aware of, you know, what other people, you know, the situation of other people, even though he was always the most celebrated person in the room. It sounds like McLuhan understood you were sitting there getting, you know, wanting to talk to Corinne, but not getting to.
Exactly. And that night was sort of one extreme. And then his arm around my shoulder saying this was the other extreme, because he was just a normal person.
But he also, when he was put in front of an audience, he didn't hold back.
Exactly.
I mean, he delivered.
And many of his lectures were not perfectly thought out, and yet they were, at least in the earlier years, totally coherent. You understood where he was going, and you followed along.
I mean, it almost sounds to me like he was a better teacher than anything else.
He was a great teacher. He was a great, great teacher.
And he never got separated from his teaching, did he, by all his success?
No. I mean, a couple of classes we had in 66, 67, there'd be a man or two sitting at the back, who was obviously from Newsweek or Time or some other place. But Marshall in the class was just himself. He was always dressed in a suit and tie. He'd always walk in unobtrusively and begin talking. And he'd end up unobtrusively, and he'd leave.
What were his favorite writers, David?
Mallarmé, Flaubert, Joyce, T.S. Eliot. These were the writers who really appealed to him, and they were writers who really were current with Yeats, with Eliot, with Joyce. They were their sources, and he relished them totally.
Did he like Rimbaud?
Yes. Rimbaud was another person.
Baudelaire?
Baudelaire, Rimbaud, yes. Those were people he really loved and he really understood. But he never talked about them in our course, because our course was on modern poetry and drama, so we couldn't bring in these other people.
I would have loved to hear him lecture on Whitman.
Whitman
just was so spectacular to me.
But he, you know, he'd talk about Whitman in ways and say what he was doing, and then after 15 minutes, he'd go into the media and what was going on, and then he'd turn back to Whitman and say, so that's all relevant.
But he had Whitman represents someone who changed the medium of American poetry.
That's right. That's right.
He really, you know, kind of blew it up and started over again.
And so when Lilacs Last in the Barnyard bloomed, is typical for McLuhan of what he could do with T.S. Eliot, what he could do with other things. And he had this range of sensitivity that always came into play.
What about his taste in music and film and so forth?
I don't know much about that. He went to some movies. I don't think he went to many. He listened to a lot of classical music. He had classical music on, so much of the time. I respected his love of literature, his enthusiasm for literature, his enthusiasm for the word.
What about his treatment of the novel apart from poetry?
We never did that because it wasn't in our course, but he read a lot. He read a lot of them. He read a lot of novels. Which ones I can't precisely say. When we wrote this essay, or when he wrote the essay, he'd be so elusive. This reminds me of that quote from George Bernard Shaw, and then he'd have to go off and find it and put it in. And this reminds me of, and he had a wealth of knowledge that came into all his thinking.
Did he have a kind of total memory of things that he had read and experienced?
He did, and I don't understand that, because when he did the essay and when he did other things, he had so much at his fingertips that were right there, as though he remembered everything he had done.
Mm.
And when he finished the essay, he immediately wanted to send a copy to his friend Pierre Trudeau. And so he sent off the essay when he finished it with a letter to Pierre, because he thought this was so superb.
Well, I have to read this, David.
And he wanted to give me some credit, and I said, don't. I didn't do anything. I just forced you to write.
You were Simon Legree.
Yes, which didn't make any sense.
The experience of being in a classroom with somebody like that is really life-changing, isn't it?
It is. And it's life-changing afterwards. I mean, he was just a very good teacher. And then you think back, and you think, and in retrospect, it becomes so seminal to our own growth.
I'll tell you, the teachers that I remember most had the biggest impact on me were teachers like McLuhan. They were teachers who, for example, quick illustration, I was in an aesthetics class, philosophy of art at the University of Texas. It would have been 1969.
Okay.
Lewis Mackey, a famous Kierkegaard scholar, was teaching this, and he brought, you know, carried in a phonograph, sat it on the table, and he played the Kyrie from the B minor Mass. Just, he didn't say anything, he just put it on. I had never heard it, David. And I thought it was the most beautiful thing I ever heard in my life. But when I looked at his face was so ecstatic. I literally said to myself, I want to be able to hear music the way Dr. Mackey is hearing music. That's my goal.
But you do.
I do now, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, but it's because I saw that I said, I don't want to, it's sort of like, I don't want to miss out on that.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, we have all, you know, this is why it's so important for students to be in classrooms and be in situations where you're not tied down to, you know, curricula or syllabi that, you know, govern every move a teacher makes in class. That's not teaching.
And yet, in these days, we're all online teaching.
I did an online course on philosophy of happiness, which was very spontaneous and worked out very well because I insisted that everybody, you know, be bright and cheery and answer my questions and be on camera. And so I didn't change anything in terms of how I taught it.
But the problem with online teaching is that I had a very, very good class last term, extremely good. And all I wanted to do, as I told them in one class, is I said, I'd just like to meet once, all face to face, and talk with each other. That's the thing you can't do online.
That's right. And it's a whole different and more personal vibe.
That's right. That's right.
What would McLuhan make of this, you know, reaction to the pandemic and being confined to teaching, you know, online?
Well, we've progressed a long way since 1980 when he died. But I think he'd enjoy it. It would be a novelty. And yet he couldn't meet the people in person. And that would be the drawback.
But he would see it as a kind of experiment, wouldn't he?
That's right. Something you do because you have to do this.
I tell our listeners, you know, go on YouTube and search for Marshall McLuhan and, you know, take 5 minutes and listen to him speak. I mean, it's really riveting.
That's right.
I mean, it's just the intelligence, the originality, the good humor, like I say, the mischievousness. You're captured, and you don't even know the man.
And when we did this collection of essays of his that came out, I think, in 2003, I reread everything he wrote, and I thought, there's so much here. There's so much here, and we need to understand it better.
David, I'd like for you to come back on Church and Culture when your book on Canadian literature is published so that we can talk more about the writers. You know, we have talked about Alistair MacLeod and Morley Callahan and Marshall McLuhan, but there's a lot more north of the border that I think our listeners would really enjoy learning about. Will you do that?
It's going to come out this summer, they tell me, from Cambridge University Press. They'll send you a copy, or I'll send you a copy, and then we can go on the air and talk.
We will, and we may even talk before that, I hope. David,
always aiming to talk.
Thank you, sir. And to all of you who are listening, I'll be back this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.